We seem to be having a little trouble. Mr. Hillier, are you with us?
Yes, sir, I am, and thank you for having me, sir.
All right, fine. Well, let me tell you a little bit about John Hillier. He's an investigative producer. He's won Emmy Awards. He's done a lot of video work. He discovered the Clinton's agenda for the youth of America while on location at the Arkansas Governor's School. And this was a special school that was designed by Bill Clinton, where they took the most intelligent of the school children and they set out to change the outlook of their minds. And so John possessed inside information on drug running activities, headquarters at Mena, Arkansas, as well as details on the mysterious deaths of people in Arkansas who just knew too much. John, how long have you been involved in trying to get out the truth about what's gone on in Arkansas?
Well, October of 92 was my first trip to Arkansas for investigative reasons, and it was indeed for the governor's school. And when I got there, I was called by a friend as I was doing my interviews that they had seen a cut piece already on the governor's school and to go on to other priorities, and I did. And I don't know how many enigmas and labyrinths there are there, but I sense that I've not gotten near the ninth circle yet.
All right, now the governor's school, let's go into that initially. This was for the talented children. The smartest children in Arkansas were to be taken to a special school, and there they were going to have their minds altered, their perspective of the world outlook altered. And instead of believing that 2 and 2 is 4, they were asked questions like, what do you think about 2 and 2? And similar serious questions that did nothing but confuse the minds of some of these younger kids. In fact, one of them went home from the governor's school and committed suicide. What do you know about the governor's school as such?
Well, indeed, he did winnow the 1,000 applicants of the junior class of Arkansas statewide down to 300 or 400, sequestered them at the Hendricks College, a left-wing United Methodist school in Conway, Arkansas. It's about 35 miles north of Little Rock. And he used some of the people who were faculty of the college to go at them for these 6 weeks, and they were domiciled there, shown films like The Life and Times of Harvey Milk.
Oh, for those who don't know, Harvey Milk was the gay supervisor from San Francisco.
Just so. And it's a very homo-friendly sex education that they decided to immerse the kids in. Emily Culpepper, I had read and found there that she was one of the opening moments for the brightest and best of these 300 or 400 kids in the state blaspheme Christ, mm-hmm. and to shock treat them into a position of saying you're going to experience things here you've never known existed before. She described herself as a lesbian witch, handed the kids off to a recruiting homosexual who said, you're probably homosexual, don't know it, and we're going to help you find out.
So it was a real homophilic.
For instance, told to build a 2-meter by 2-meter box, get inside the box, and as they were there, they were told, this is how much the Jews had for room in the boxcars on the way to Auschwitz, and this is what it's like to be gay in America.
I see. So it was really a homophilic experience for them. They were indoctrinating these people in acceptance of a death style that has already killed over 100,000 homosexuals. And, of course, the whole theme of the liberal establishment is to accept this death style as if it's quite normal.
And indeed empower it.
Right.
The other themes were Marxism and nihilism.
All right. What about the Marxist or socialist influence there as far as the young people were concerned? Because, of course, the path to controlling a country is to control the mind of the smartest youth. And so they were really indoctrinating them in Marxism?
Just so. And the worst thing I'd found is the death cult theme that Brandon Hawks, you described as one of the victims of it. He was a very outgoing and loved young man. He was first chair clarinet in the state orchestra, and they had one outing in which they had access to people not in the school, and it was the 4th of July fireworks, and they were forbidden to speak to their friends. That's a violation of their civil rights. But because he was a very gregarious young man, they found him there on the village green, and the kids came over and said, how you doing, Brandon? What's going on? He talked to them. Whatever they did to him to punish him emotionally, he wouldn't tell his parents. It was so terrible. He was the boy who subsequently committed suicide. They punished him for speaking to his friends.
But basically, the whole idea was a conditioning process, something like outcomes-based education, where you alter their perception of themselves, of society, and of reality. Wasn't that basically the thrust of the program?
Just so. And forgive me, I'm at a car dealership with my car here, and that's why the announcement in the background. The quintessential moment, I guess, was they had hired a man named Mark Lowry to be their public relations director. And unfortunately for them, he was Christian, and is, in fact, the lieutenant governor of Arkansas's chief of staff today. And he found soon into the experience that he was not indeed to publish the school, but to obfuscate, to make sure the parents and the people in the state at large did not find out the agenda. And the telling moment for him was when one of the faculty came into the lounge slapping his knee and laughing, saying, it worked, and he said, what worked? He said, well, you know, these kids have been a little resistant to our program here, what we're doing with their minds, and so what I did today was I put a Bible under my arm, walked into the room and put it on the table in front of me, and they bought everything. They were putty in my hands, and he thought that was the biggest joke that he had played on them. Mark realized at this point, if he hadn't before, that he was participating in evil, and so he began to be a problem, and was soon forced out. They've been after him since, one way or another. But that is the, well, I guess the other quintessential thing that I've found is that in interviewing the father and the uncle of the murdered boy, they said when Brandon died, we got calls from around the state from other parents who said, we don't know what they've done, but our kids have the same symptoms as yours, and we're afraid that our kids are going to commit suicide, too. What has the governor done to our kids?
Well, what he wants to do to the kids of this entire nation, this is the thrust of the new Goals 2000 educational program that is being forced on our schools all across the nation for a threat they won't get their government money if they don't let this new government program of altered reality come into the schools. We're going to have to take a quick break here, John, and we want to talk briefly about something that I know you're well acquainted with, and that is an excellent video called The Clinton Chronicles. And for those of you who don't know what this video is, it has caused more consternation across the country. In fact, there was an article in the U.S. News and World Report recently that said that the third man on the grassy knoll in Dallas in November of 1963 was really Bill Clinton. In fact, he's even been associated with the assassination of Abraham Lincoln. And using this type of ridicule, they're trying to play down the impact of this tremendous video, which is called The Clinton Chronicles. It's basically the compilation of 40-some hours of interviews into 82 minutes, which are packed-filled. It's a story of bribery, of beatings, of threats, of intimidation, of violence, and actually of murder. It's an amazing video. You should see it. It's available for $24.95 by calling 1-800-5-HIV-WAR. There are interviews with people like the former, or the present Attorney General of Arkansas. When asked about why he didn't do anything about what was going on in MENA, he said, because I'm not allowed to investigate the drugs going down in MENA. Who can control the Attorney General of a state? Well, it's a fascinating story. You won't want to miss it. You need to get the video. You need to watch it. You need to show it to your friends, because if we have people of this category in Washington, D.C., America's in trouble. And this is Dr. Stan here on Radio Liberty. Our guest this afternoon, John Hillier, investigative producer and an investigative reporter, I suppose. Basically, tell us a little bit about then some of the stories we hear concerning Vince Foster. What is this story about the woman? It was Chelsea's nanny, a lady that had seen Vince Foster dead in a car before he was found there. Her name was Helen Dickey, wasn't it? Tell us about that story.
Well, sir, I don't know much more than you do, except that the Senate decided that that was not something that they wanted to ask Dr. Beyer about or any of the other people, that Mr. Fisk has ignored the existence of this woman's testimony, and so has the press. That's how you know it's important.
Well, why don't you tell us a little bit about it? Because I think most of our listeners know the press is controlled in America. Why don't you tell us what you do know about this story?
Well, she reputedly came into the White House saying that Vince has shot himself in the parking lot. And she then called the present governor of the state and of spoke
Arkansas.
For some time,
right.
Guy Tucker. And she was terrified to find that this was going on. And you'll notice that the press has not gone to her to say, why would you create this terrible agony for the family of the Fosters in having broached such a fantastic, terrible tale? No one has embarrassed her. No one has wanted to speak to her. It's very much like not wanting to speak to the cleaning lady that the morning after his death, the park police were held at bay by the Secret Service from 8:30 to 9 in the morning with the premise that you can't go in yet because the cleaning lady is not through in Vince Foster's office yet. Now, that's a prima facie crime. No one has pursued the cleaning lady. Have you noticed that this press who snickers at us has not chosen to look for either Helen Dickey or the cleaning lady?
Well, no, I thought it was the cleaning lady. I thought Bernard Nussbaum was in Vince Foster's office and wouldn't let anybody in until they had cleaned everything out of the office. They had Hillary's secretary was there. There were three or four people who went through all of Vince Foster's papers to make sure there was nothing there having to do with national security, even though they themselves had no national security clearance. But they didn't want the park police to get any information out of Vince Foster's office until they'd gotten everything out of there that might be, let's say, incriminating.
And if no one else, as Mr. Nussbaum walked out of the White House in reverential silence from the press corps, and you could have seen his picture on any network, there must have been 15 crews out there at least as he left. Not one question from the gallery. It would have put the question in play of why, in fact, under national security premises, he would violate an evidentiary preserve because, as you have pointed out, sir, he didn't have a security clearance to look at that kind of material. But, in fact, the people who believe that we are irresponsible for our reportage in this, please refer, because every library that I know of in the country subscribes to the Washington Post, get the August 15th, 93 issue, where there is a voluminous article about Vince Foster having been looking for a lawyer for himself that week, and that we have the narrative by the park police of their encounter being obstructed in their pursuit of a forensic investigation of that office, and that Bernie Nussbaum came out and spoke to them saying, fellas, we're sorry we had to go into the office last night, but we want you to know that we only spent 10 minutes, looked on the top of Vince's desk and a couple of drawers, and we want you to know that we disturbed nothing and we removed no documents.
Well, you know, if there's nothing to hide, why did they go into the office? What were they looking for? And it wasn't just 10 minutes. It was quite a bit longer, wasn't it? I understood it was several hours.
I understood 2 hours as they were sorting the papers, and that we find 5 months later that someone... And the wars and the issues of life seem to always be won on the margins. That someone in the Secret Service, I have to believe, called Jerry Sieper of the Washington Times and gave them the story. Obviously, gentlemen, you're not going to find what Bernie did that night, and so we're going to tell you. 5-foot-long file boxes he removed that night. Having told you he removed nothing, he lied. And Mr. Nussbaum, I understood, was under some duress of indictment about this, but we've heard nothing broached at all about that. He got to have his Senate hearings and walked out smiling.
Well, the trouble is when the Senate is totally under Democratic control, they're only shams to try to convince the American people that the truth is being brought out. When both the House and the Senate are under Democratic control, we can be sure we will not get the truth, unless perhaps this new gentleman, Kenneth Starr, the new special investigator, will bring things out. Do you know anything at all about him, John?
Well, sir, only what you know, that he was a federal appeals judge, and we'll go back to that job, I suppose, after this. And it is, I have to believe, a miracle. And the miracle was engineered by people who knew that justice was not being carried forth, and I think they caught them blindside. Janet Reno thought that she could go ahead and install him as not only the special counsel, but the independent counsel. And if you were a White House reporter this weekend looking for a story from the White House, you would be hard-pressed to get it because everyone was at Camp David.
Trying to figure out what to do next. Well, tell us a little bit about Larry Nichols. I understand Larry Nichols now has been arrested. This is the gentleman who is the star of the film
Clinton Chronicles, the gentleman who's been trying to bring out the truth about violence and beatings and bribery and murder and sex in dealing in Arkansas while Bill Clinton was there. And now somebody's got charges out and they've arrested Larry Nichols to try to silence him. What's the background there?
Well, I hope it was providential that I was there Wednesday. I was going to leave in the morning, and we had events overtake us that I needed to stay. And I said, well, I've got to at least cull a few of my notes to give it to a friend who is investigating the death of the boys on the railroad tracks for us and how that implicates Bill Clinton. And in any case, I was making these notes when a call came in from the widow of Jerry Parks, Jane Parks.
Okay, now for the listener who doesn't know, Jerry Parks was a private investigator who had been investigating Bill Clinton for a period of 10 years and had all sorts of files about Bill Clinton's extramarital affairs. And he was mysteriously shot down on the streets of Little Rock, just outside of Little Rock, a few months after Vince Foster's strange demise.
Just so.
Okay. And not only that,
Jerry Parks,
his files disappeared.
She's a very dear lady. We spent some hours with her interviewing her and talking to her afterwards to get to understand why this all happened. She was the manager of the Vantage Point Apartments in Little Rock, and as Providence would have it, I guess, she shared a wall from her office to an apartment on the backside of the apartments, which was rented by Roger Clinton. And one day she told me that a car, as she came out of the back, saw a car was parked in front of her office, and she never allowed that. And so she went to find the driver and went around the corner to find the door opened at the point where the fellow was handing a plastic bag full of white powder to Roger Clinton. And she told him, you've got to get the car out of here. He said, I'm going, lady, and got out. It was probably an hour later that she got calls from the residents saying, you've got to quell this terrible disturbance back there. She went back, opened the door, she knocked, and there was not only Roger, but Bill Clinton with the teenage girls all over them. And Bill was glazed to a point he didn't even know she was in the room. He was so lost on coke. And so she saw the governor's limo sitting there, and the state troopers obviously are driving her. L.D. Brown is the man evidently that day. And this happened over and over. And she couldn't go to the local police, couldn't go to the state troopers, so she went to her husband, said, Jerry, I need help. Please at least document this to protect us, because we may be implicated as cocaine dealers or something here. At least get this in a place where it's evidence. And that's what killed Jerry Parks, is he developed a file from 1983 on to 1993.
That was the background. Okay, so there was
in any case, she has been terrorized since. She has been visited by people who said they were FBI, x-rayed the walls of the house to see if, in fact, there were copies of the file, left, and then the FBI says, we've never been there.
So, in other words, they're very anxious to get those files. Maybe somebody has those files and they're hidden because not only Mrs. Parks, but her son, Gary Parks, says that he's been broken into several times. So somebody's still looking for those files and somebody has them.
And she's been terrorized, run off the road several times, had a gun pointed at her. But Wednesday last, she called, very furtive, from her car phone, saying, I need help. The state police won't help. I'm being pursued at 80 miles an hour by a gray van, two large white males in it. I'm on the phone with the state police, and I'm passing them at 80 miles an hour. They've not even come out to stop me for speeding. I need help. And the phone went dead. Well, I didn't have her mobile number. I called her house number, obviously not there. And I called Larry Nichols at this moment to see if he knew her mobile phone number. And he said, I don't know the number, but I'm being arrested right now. Get up here. And so we had gotten two hang-up calls at the safe house in Arkansas. So it occurred to me that they were going after all of us at once. And I went to her house, first of all, having called the cavalry in, some policemen and state troopers who are friends, to get there. And didn't find anybody at the house. And I came out and I saw that I was being surveyed, if you will. As I turned onto Route 10, where Jerry Parks was killed, I was 200 yards from where they killed him. And I saw this fellow on a truck phone, and I felt he'll be after me, and they probably set me up here. They didn't, though, and I went on to the Federal Express to get three very valuable videotapes out, and then went up to get the story on Larry and see what I do to get him out of jail, and young Gary Parks had gone up and put his bank account, his furniture, everything up to make a $5,000 bond to get him out. So his jail experience, well, I'll back up just a little bit. About 14 days ago, he got a call from a man, Larry Case, who was a private investigator, who had his license suspended, had $13,000 in fines. There was an arrest warrant out for Larry Case. Sometime after Jerry Parks' death, that case was pulled. There is no more warrant. There is no more fine on Larry Case. Larry Case called him saying, Clinton's people want to meet with you and settle your differences. I'm to take you to a meet. And he said, I'm not going anywhere with you for a meet.
Now, this was said, Larry Nichols. They wanted to meet with him, maybe sort of like they met with Hoffa. Is that the...
Yes, I think so. He would become part of the stadium.
Right.
And he said, I've got $500 to find you, and I get another $500 for delivering you. You're going. And he said, no, we're not. And he said, I'm going to come get you. And he said, all right, I'll meet you on the road. Don't come to my house. And he came to the rendezvous, and Case was there, and he brought his .38. And he said, if I knew you were going to bring your piece, I'd bring mine. He said, all right, back away from the car. And he threw the .38 on the passenger seat. As he got out, he glanced back to see if he had left the hammer back. And at that point, Larry Case kicked the door into him, re-breaking the ribs. He had been attacked back in, I think, January when he was seeing his dying father in the hospital in the parking lot. And they had broken those ribs. The same ribs got broken by the car door. But even after that, Larry Case wound up face down with some facial injuries.
In other words, Larry Nichols to put him down after this altercation.
Yes, sir. Larry Case showed up at his house last Wednesday to say, we need to talk and settle our differences. And
okay, you're going to have to hold that thought right there, and I want to remind our listeners not to think about turning off the radio, because we'll be back right after the next commercial announcement. And that is for a video that you need to see. It's called Day 51. It is the story of what really happened at Waco, not what Dan Rather or Barbara Walters or Tom Brokaw or Robert McNeil will tell you, but what really happened from the point of view of the Davidians. And this video was put out by the Davidians, and it gives you the interviews with the people who were actually inside. You'll get a chance to meet them, to hear their story of, you know, of the attack. It's entirely different than what you were allowed to see on television through the controlled media. Ladies and gentlemen, if they can go in and kill 80-some or 90-some women and children at Waco, he can do it in any state in this union. Where is the outrage? Where is the cry? You need to get this video. You need to show it to your friends. You can get it by calling 1-800-5-HIV-WAR. Just tell them you want the Waco video. It's $24.95. We pick up shipping and handling, but you need to get it. You need to get the message out, because if it can happen in Waco, it can happen here. And this is Dr. Stan back here with John Hillier, who happens to be, if you hear the background, he happens to be in a automotive repair shop, but we're with him by telephone now. And tell us now, you were telling us about Larry Nichols, who is the star of the Clinton Chronicles, who has been arrested and indicted for something or other, and you were telling me that they had first of all sent somebody to get him, and when he wouldn't go, they broke his ribs, and then the gentleman called Case called him again, and that's where we left the story. Go on, John.
And came to his house and sat down pretending to be in the reconciliation business. 2 minutes after he sat down, three deputy sheriffs came through the door, treated him very rudely, and took him to the detention center. It was at that moment, as they were arresting him, that I had called him. And I certainly think that's providential timing. And when I arrived, young Gary Parks was putting up all of his possessions in a bank account to make this $5,000 bond. And it was a few more minutes that Larry was released. He had about a two-hour experience in a very rough cell.
Now, well, what was the basis of their... What were they arresting him for? Because we know...
There were three charges, all of them spurious.
Okay,
one of them,
fine.
He's vulnerable, too, because he's so trusting. He's a musician. He evidently bought a guitar, at least it was a guitar shop, and it was an $885 check he had post-dated and given to this man several years ago. And he had made payments toward the face amount of the check, and he finished the payments and brought it into the man's shop, and his wife was there saying he's out of town. He said, that's okay, just tell him to tear the check up when he gets back, not getting a cash receipt, because that's the way he's always done things. And he was obviously put up to this. Man called him and said, you need to pay me the $885, and he said, you know that I have, and you're not going to extort me. And lo and behold, that was one of the charges that he was imprisoned for. The other major charge were a large amount of fines, traffic fines, for a Jeep Eagle, and he's never owned a Jeep Eagle. The only thing that really mattered was that they get him in the cell that night. He got a call at home that night and told us that somebody gave him a tip saying, you were not coming out of that cell alive, that there was a $1,000 bounty, that whoever killed you, beat you to death that night, got the $1,000.
For the continuation of this program, please turn the tape over now.
County that he had helped elect twice, the only felony, Bob Blankenship, was in Washington Wednesday, not available to get a call from him because he was in Washington. I wonder what his itinerary in Washington was.
Well, I have no idea, but I know that certainly there is total corruption in Arkansas. They couldn't have had all the murders down there associated with MENA. They couldn't have covered up the drug smuggling at MENA unless there is powerful forces working within the police there. In fact, a number of the police officers have come forward and talked about the corruption. In fact, on the Clifton Chronicles, there's an interview with the gentleman who is formerly head of the State Police Officers Association, pointing out that they had investigated the drugs for years, they had all the goods, and nobody would do anything about it because of the corruption of the legal system. And so if they can hold back and they can conceal the facts concerning the drugs at MENA, they certainly can arrest a gentleman who's making the life of Bill Clinton a little more interesting, we might say. In fact, I know that the video Clinton Chronicles was hand-delivered to every senator and every congressman in Washington, D.C. A couple of pages just came back to our area from Washington, D.C., who said everybody in Washington's talking about it, but they couldn't get hold of a copy to see it. And so one of our listeners bought 50 copies of the tape because she wanted to get the information out all in this area. And I hope the people who are listening feel as deeply about this as she does. Somebody's got to get these tapes out because they've arrested Larry. Now, is he out on bail at the present time?
Yes, sir, he is. He's got a court date a week from today.
And basically, does he have any legal defense? Does he have anybody who's helping him with these charges?
We are working hard at getting the right legal counsel. It's not only getting legal counsel, it's getting one who is actually working for you in the state of Arkansas.
Well, of course, there's always Lynn Davis, who is the gentleman who's representing the troopers.
That's a good point. What we've been told is that you have to get a Faulkner County attorney if you have a case in Faulkner County.
Well, now that's ridiculous.
Parochial.
You should be able to get any sort of lawyer you want to, but I guess they're going to make it as difficult as possible, huh?
They certainly have managed.
All right. Now, has the sheriff come back? Is he going along with this trumped-up
charge? I don't know, because I had to leave 2 o'clock that morning. The other thing that happened that night was he called us at midnight saying that there are two cars parked outside his house.
In other words, they're trying to intimidate him, this constant fear to get him to be quiet, to back off.
That's it.
Okay, now, ladies and gentlemen, this sort of thing is not imaginary. These things go on in America. I know because I've been subject to this in years past, many, many years ago when I was doing something. Well, that's another story. Maybe we can go into that. But this sort of thing really can happen in America, and evidence can disappear. People can die, and nothing is done about it. Can you tell us the story about the two boys who fell asleep on the railway track? That's an amazing story.
Well, I'll try. It's probably the thing that has driven me more than any other issue because it's such an outrage. The people who put those two boys on the track knew that the father of one of the boys is a train engineer who would have been driving the train that night, would have rolled over his own son. That's how cruel and vile they are. They came across a drop. This drop is a very strategic place.
Now, you're talking
on an aerial
about
map.
A drug drop.
Yes, that
okay.
is owned by your intelligence services. The boys were told of this drug delivery, and they decided, I guess, to either pounce it or at least go for the adventure of it or whatever. In any case,
they were just teenage kids. What were they?
They were 16.
Okay.
It happened in 87, August 23rd. And Kevin Ives and Don Henry were the two boys. And whatever they stumbled across, it got them killed. And we're told that it's not only what they saw, but who they saw picking up the drugs.
Okay, fine. So
but and I can't tell you the name yet. I'm sorry.
Okay, but basically...
But the name of the names of those people will tell you why it was very important on up to the governor's mansion.
Okay, so then they were killed. One of them had his head smashed in. The other one was stabbed. Then they were placed on the train tracks. And then the train ran over them. And the state examiner said they just fell asleep on the train tracks. It was just a natural death, nothing to worry about. And it was only when the family insisted on autopsies over the objection of the Clinton-appointed state health officer that eventually autopsies were performed that they found that one had been stabbed and the other had their head bashed in before the train ran over them. So then what happened? Now, weren't there a number of people who tried to come forward and tell the story who also met mysterious deaths, about six of them?
Well, it starts with seven and it goes on up to about 15.
Okay, now 15 deaths associated with this.
Yes, sir.
Okay, fine.
And some of them are the people who killed the former people. The thing that the thugs don't figure out is they're too expensive to keep around. I guess that's been a disease amongst the people who do that for a living for a long time. But in one of the saddest cases is Keith McCaskill, who was described in very rough terms, but I've come to know about Keith McCaskill, and it's a very painful story because he, in fact, had been a Baptist Sunday school superintendent. I'm afraid his wife left with a preacher. It made him very bitter. He went and bought a bar called the Wagon Wheel on the county line of Saline and Pulaski counties, and that's Pulaski County is where Little Rock resides. And he married again, and his wife said, I want you out of that sleazy business, and he said, hon, I'll get out of it. I'll sell it, and he did. The man was losing the business. He didn't know how to do it, and he asked Keith to come back as manager. Keith used to hear all the burglaries, the crimes. The criminal element would come into the Wagon Wheel and talk about it in front of him. And so he was a police informant, and he had gotten into some rough things himself. When the boys died and Linda Ives, mother of Kevin Ives, went to him as a mother and said, Keith, would you help me find the murderers of my son? And he just cleaned his act up right away and started to help her. He was an expert photographer, had a Hasselblad camera. He had been invited to the Capitol steps to photograph politicians in Washington. He took aerial shots of the area, and he discovered where the drug drops were and how they got there. He brought that evidence to the wrong people, and he called his mother as soon as he brought it to the authorities. He said, Mother, this is the last time that I'll be able to speak to you on earth. I'm calling to say goodbye. I want you to know that I'll see you in heaven. The Lord has redeemed me. But I brought my evidence to the wrong people, and they're going to murder me for it. I brought it to the authorities, and Mother, you know who's going to kill me. Well, she didn't know the people in Saline County, but she knows Bill Clinton. And he was stabbed in 48 hours 115 times coming home to his garage. They tried to put the story, the crime off on a young boy, 19 years of age, I think, at the time. And it was such an embarrassment that they let the boy out of prison on a technicality and never retried him or anyone else for it. The people who killed him have subsequently been killed, at least several of them have that we know of. So there indeed is a reflexive response, and Bill Clinton has a term that he's used in the hearing of people that I've spoken to. When you turn information over to him about someone who may be a threat to him, he says, I'll take care of it through the back door. The back door has been a very horrific experience for the people of Arkansas because there's no jurisprudence. If you want to turn in the criminals who are connected to the drug business, you, in fact, will be the next victim. You will not get justice in the state. He's doing that to America. We have a Justice Department that we see his print on that is horrific. If we let him continue to Arkansize America, we will not have a constitution to defend soon, I fear.
There is a new book out called On the Make, Bill Clinton on the Way to the White House by Mrs. Oakley. Do you know anything about the story?
I've heard about the book. I haven't gotten it yet. I've just been underwater with what we've been doing, but I've heard about that, and I'm sending a Slick Willie 2 out.
Okay, fine. Let me just mention to our listeners that we are going to have Mrs. Oakley on our program here in about 2 weeks. I'm not going to tell you when because you're going to have to listen every afternoon. You won't want to miss this. She was a reporter. She spoke to Bill Clinton every day for 10 years, but when she wanted to do the unauthorized biography, he wouldn't talk to her. I think it's going to be an excellent interview, but I'm not going to tell you what it is. So either you listen or get somebody else to tape it, because you'll hear even, I'm sure, almost as amazing things as you're hearing this afternoon this is a very dangerous man who doesn't allow people to cross him, and if they do, they end up dead. And all the ridicule that you're going to see in the U.S. News and World Report and Time and Newsweek and New York Times and Washington Post, it shows the control over the media and the ridicule that will be used as anybody tries to bring up the truth about what's going on. And if you're not taping these programs and distributing to your friends, you're not doing what's necessary if we have any hope of saving America. If you want to get the programs, you can write to us at Post Office Box 13 in Santa Cruz, 95063. Any and all of the tape programs are available to you for $6.50. But we need to get this information out. This is not imaginary. This is real. These people play for keeps. Larry Nichols' life is in danger. I'm sure John Hillier's life is in danger. Anybody who begins to question what's going on, life is in danger. It's just like it was in Hitler's Germany. Ladies and gentlemen, this is not imaginary. And now for our next break, I want to tell you about another excellent video that we're offering. It's called Americans Abandoned. And it's a story of the boys from towns just like yours and mine who went off to Vietnam to fight for freedom. Well, they were willing to go and risk their lives or being crippled or maybe even die, but the one thing they weren't willing to do was be abandoned by their government and then have that sinister and evil force which occupies Washington, D.C., lie to the American people about them being there, and they were left, and the Vietnamese actually wanted to get them out, and we don't want them back. That's the truth of the matter. You want to get this tape, Americans Abandoned, produced by Captain Red McDaniels, who himself was a prisoner of war, 1-800-5-HIV-WAR, 1-800-544-8927. They went there to fight for you. What are you doing, willing to do to fight for them? And as Ronald Reagan said, any government that will betray its fighting men will also betray its citizens. And this is Dr. Stan back here on Radio Liberty. Our guest this afternoon, John Hillier, who's investigative reporter. John, what do you really do for a living? Are you just investigating this? Are you putting together new videos? What are you doing to try to get the true story about what's going on in our country?
Well, there are several echelons of this story, and we are trying to put together those items to bring a coherent case for the use of the Senate and the House, if they will, and for the American people to know what to demand of their Congress. The last subpoena power in this country that will be in the way of what they intend to do to us rests in the Congress of the United States. There is no other uncompromised body, and we've seen what Henry Gonzalez is willing to do to open the hearings, having promised only two items would be allowed in their investigation, and he shut off the Vince Foster side. We also saw that Captain Hume, who gave a very angry deposition, it seemed to me from the reading, that he was very upset that because he was one of the National Park Police who showed up at the White House the next morning after Vince Foster's death and was told that he couldn't go in until the cleaning lady was through. And Captain Hume said 2 days before, "I'm available 24 hours a day, call me." And suddenly, the hearings open, and he cannot be found even on a beeper. And we're told he went on vacation, and no one has pursued that. Have you seen any reporters looking for Captain Hume? Have you seen a story on him? I've not. The other one is that they promised to, I'm sorry, I just lost that other party. It wasn't the Helen Dickey element, and I'll come back to it. I apologize. But
well, don't feel bad, because it's awfully easy to lose your train of thought when you're on radio and you're being heard from San Francisco down to Bakersfield.
Well, I thank you for your forgiveness and for all the announcements here in the background. My car was supposed to have been ready, and I'm stuck here because it wasn't. And so thank you for putting up with this. But the other issues, some of them you have just addressed in your last promo for the Americans Abandoned. What you need to know is that the same criminals who are putting drugs in the schoolyards with your intelligence apparatus and your tax dollars and your airplanes are the people who have betrayed our MIAs and are making sure that they don't come home.
And you're speaking now of
come home free.
You're speaking now of American government officials.
Yes, I am.
All right, fine. Do you want to elaborate on that a little bit? Of course, for the skeptic out there, we do have a wonderful book. It's called Kiss the Boys Goodbye, written by a producer for CBS. The most amazing story, not only of the boys we abandoned, but the story of the CIA involvement in drugs. You wonder why we're not winning the drug war? Because we're not trying to win the drug war. We're throwing this. There's example after example of CIA involvement at MENA, CIA bringing drugs in, CIA telling the DEA that this was an undercover movement, you know, to try to catch the drug dealers, but they just never catch any drug dealers. But the drugs are on the streets of America because we're not trying to win the war. The war on drugs is fought not against the drug dealers. It's fought against the American people, controlling your money, controlling your guns, controlling your bank accounts. You can't take over $10,000 out without getting into real trouble, without that being reported. If you try to take it out in increments so it won't be reported, you become guilty of structuring. But all of this is justified in the name of fighting the war on drugs. No, it's fighting the war on the American population, because they have an agenda, and that agenda is total control over every aspect of our lives, just exactly as Bill Clinton imposed in Arkansas, where everyone lived in fear because they knew if they got out of line with the governor, they could end up just like the boys on the railway tracks.
And the boys on railroad tracks, by the way, are a story that is of great interest to those people you've just mentioned. I interviewed a former CIA player, and this man knows things that I couldn't invent, and we talked about them for hours. When the conversation just happened to touch on the boys on the railroad tracks, he leaned forward and said, "What do you know about that?" And I told him my theory, and I think that I know the people who killed the boys. He said, "You know too much for your own good." The CIA cares very much about this investigation because they know that it takes their client, Bill Clinton, down. That he got into the case in two significant ways. He had Betsy Wright, his chief of staff, involve herself in the case, and there's an exhibit in the grand jury by her. And also, I'm told that he had legislation passed during the grand jury. It lasted 18 months to make sure that they changed the law of how grand jury reports were executed. They used to be a 30 or 40 page document for anything that took that much evidence. It is a page and a quarter, most of it devoted to thanking the local prosecutor for his hard work and his staff and going to places like New Jersey to investigate the death of the boys in Arkansas. I don't think that they would like to have to answer the question of what indeed did they do in New Jersey when they were there. But in any case, Clinton is very much attached to the boys on the tracks. Sami Malik was a man he would not fire under several outrages. There are forensic cases.
For the listeners, let me understand who Malik was. He was the state health commissioner or state health advisor who was appointed by Clinton, who covered up the death of the boys. And despite the fact that, it was obviously that they had been murdered, he kept insisting they'd just fallen asleep on the railway tracks. And when the information was brought out that he had lied, they put in faulty information, Bill Clinton kept him in power.
He's still on the state payroll today.
Right. And so if you do the right thing for Bill, you get ahead. Just this is why Jocelyn Elders did well. And, of course, Malik and Jocelyn Elders played important parts in covering for Bill Clinton's mother, who killed several people when she was giving anesthesia, and she was allowed just to sort of fade away into the darkness. Nothing was ever done. It was all covered up by Malik and Jocelyn. That's why Jocelyn's where she is today.
And I think we need to indeed couch the health care reform plan in the term which it deserves, elders care.
Yes, in fact, I've heard that they're thinking of getting Dr. Kevorkian is the health commissioner. I hope that's just a vicious rumor. Go on.
Certainly for the son of Jocelyn Elders, who benefited from the recent suicide of the young man who was the undercover agent who sold him the drugs and whose testimony got him convicted and sentenced.
Oh, isn't that an interesting coincidence? He just committed suicide right after they put Jocelyn Elders' son away. I wonder why. Was he very despondent over that?
Obviously, he had terrible remorse about doing that.
Right. Go on.
We need to rise to the rescue of people in the Justice Department, these DEA people who are courageous enough to go after her son. They have suffered terribly for having done their job in this case.
But, this is just like a Tom Clancy novel. It goes on and on, and there are more bodies. And the American public is so interested in watching television, and, Monday Night Football is going to be coming on. When are people going to get involved Because if we don't get involved, who will? If we aren't committed to saving America, are we going to depend upon Jocelyn Elders, Janet Reno, the hero of Waco, and Bill Clinton to save America? Or is it the responsibility of you, the listening audience, to become involved in this battle for the survival of Western civilization? Go on, John. I'm sorry. I get on my soapbox here.
We'll treat the death of Kathy Ferguson. Kathy Ferguson, the ex-wife of the state trooper who admitted taking Paula Jones up to the hotel room, the Excelsior hotel room, for Bill Clinton that day, and the reason that he, Danny Ferguson, is a co-defendant with United States President. When she died back May 11, the Arkansas Democrat, this crusading paper for truth, did not give her a story at all. The only treatment she got in that paper is a hometown girl, the ex-wife of the co-defendant of the President of the United States, got an obit only. The LA Times, I understand, immediately came out with a 2-inch story in the back pages averring that, in fact, she did commit suicide and it had nothing to do with Paula Jones' case.
And then didn't
That's
her...
responsible journalism.
And then didn't her boyfriend commit suicide over her...
A month and a day after Kathy Ferguson supposedly put a .38 caliber pistol to her right temple, Bill Shelton, her boyfriend and Sherwood police officer, went to her grave after partying all night, 5 o'clock in the morning, left his friends, and went immediately to the gravesite and put a .40 caliber pistol behind his right ear and shot himself. We're to believe.
Well, you know,
the bottom half of the front page of the paper when that happened. What you haven't heard is that I've spoken to people who, at the funeral parlor, pulled her hair back, and in fact, the entrance wound is 4 inches behind her left ear.
That's more like an execution than a suicide.
Just so.
I mean, nobody ever
would have been the first witness that Paula Jones would have called in her trial, because she not only corroborated her story, but had one much worse. Sexual harassment is the point of this case, but in the case of Kathy Ferguson, when she divorced Dan, Bill Clinton asked Dan for pictures of her as soon as this was happening, of her in bathing suits and other lingerie, if he had them, and asked, would you mind if I dated your wife? Kathy Ferguson told her friends that she was at the governor's mansion because her husband was head of security for Clinton as a state trooper, that she was pinned in the pantry by him and physically assaulted. She had a much worse story to tell on the witness stand than Paula Jones does. And we're to believe that a responsible press out there has ignored the fact that Chief Crockett of the Sherwood Police Department, when he went to the scene to investigate her death, told his people to treat this as a homicide. That story has not broached, except when Bill Shelton died, then they had a little sub-paragraph near the end of the story that mentions that. No journalist that I know has pursued that story, and they say they're the responsible people.
Well, I think anybody who reads the media with a jaundiced eye realizes that most of the articles are there to influence and control our reality rather than to give us the truth. John, we're out of time. It's been a fascinating hour. I want to thank you so much for being with us, and I hope we can call on you again sometime in the not-too-distant future as this incredible story continues to unfold.
It's my privilege to have your microphone, sir. Thank you very much.
Thank you, and may God keep you safe, because believe me, you're involved in dangerous business, as you well know.
And God keep you close, sir.
Thanks, sir. Bye-bye.